From 2009 to 2011, he reported on the war in Afghanistan for the Washington Post. His mission? To reveal the impact of President Obama's decision to double U.S. force levels. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, my guest is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He'll detail the difficulties that followed the troop surge in Afghanistan, and he'll also take us way back to the 1960s and America's failed plan to transform Afghanistan from a desert to a breadbasket. The project known as Little America is also the title of Chandrasekaran's latest book, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. After this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is Rajiv Chandrasekaran, a senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post, author of the new book Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. From 2009 to 2011, he reported on the war in Afghanistan for The Post. He traveled extensively through the southern provinces of Helmand and Kandahar. His eye there was to reveal the impact of President Obama's decision to double U.S. force levels in Afghanistan. 2003 and 2004, he was the Post's bureau chief in Baghdad, and prior to that, prior to 2003, before the U.S.-led war in Iraq, he was the Washington Post's bureau chief in Cairo. His previous book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, became a best-selling account of the troubled American effort to reconstruct Iraq. The award-winning book provided a firsthand view of life inside Baghdad's Green Zone, named one of the ten best books of 2007 by the New York Times. And Rajiv Chandrasekaran will be in Iowa tomorrow, speaking to the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. And Rajiv Chandrasekaran joins us, not from Iowa, but he's still in Washington at the Washington Post, where they have a studio, and he joins us. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Great to be on with you. Good afternoon.
Let's go back to the earlier story, start there anyway, told in your book, Little America. You take the reader back to the 1950s and 60s to describe what is a massive construction project aimed at transforming the valley along Afghanistan's Helmand River into a modern society. And this was right in the early part of the Cold War. How did this come about, and tell us about it?
Well, it's a remarkable tale. You know, most Americans think that our engagement in Afghanistan began in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, or perhaps in the 1980s when the Soviets invaded. But in fact, it started in the late 1940s. It's a tale that actually begins with the Holocaust and with Jewish fur traders fleeing Europe, resettling in the United States, needing a new source for wool pelts, and turning to Afghanistan, whose hills abound with the Persian fat-tailed sheep. And in the late 30s and early 40s, Afghanistan exported millions of these pelts to the United States. And all of that trade put $100 million in the coffers of Afghanistan's treasury. So in the wake of the Second World War, the young king in Kabul was very impressed what the U.S. had done with the Tennessee Valley Authority during the Great Depression, said, I want to hire the best engineers in the world to turn this barren desert in the southwestern part of my country along the banks of the Helmand River into a verdant agricultural oasis, a breadbasket to ease the pain of frequent food shortages in his country. And so he hired a California-based company that had built the Hoover Dam and the San Francisco Bay Bridge to come to Afghanistan. And so in the early 1950s and through the 60s, American engineers were tromping through the deserts of southern Afghanistan, designing and building irrigation canals, dams, reservoirs. It was a giant effort aimed at trying to develop Afghanistan. The project didn't work out as hoped. Unfortunately, the soil in southern Afghanistan is very saline, and it doesn't lend to great agricultural cultivation. And unfortunately, the irrigation project only exacerbated the problems because the Afghans don't use drip irrigation. They tend to flood their land. And because of poor drainage, the water just pooled on the fields. And so after a while, this project began to get increasingly troubled, and the costs were escalating. So the Afghan government terminated its contract with this American engineering company. Well, as you were noting in your question, this all happened in the late 50s. Well, this was in the height of the Cold War. The Soviets were already active in northern Afghanistan, and Washington could not afford to let this project fall into ruin. So in 1961, shortly after President John F. Kennedy established the U.S. Agency for International Development, Afghanistan became one of the new aid agency's biggest priorities, and we sent over dozens more engineers to try to fix the problems that had been caused earlier. That didn't quite happen as hoped for. A lot of great solutions were proposed, but they just weren't in keeping with the traditions or culture of mm-hmm. Afghanistan. My favorite example of this is we thought that one way to fix this problem would be to flatten the fields, to level them, and that way water might run off more effectively. So the Americans brought in dozens of bulldozers. Well, the plan was to move the Afghans off their land, bulldoze the land, and then invite them back onto their farm parcels. Well, the Afghans were very concerned that if they left their land, they'd never get it back. So the American bulldozers arrived, and the Afghans met them with rifles. Thus began a years-long effort with the Americans coming up with solutions only to be foiled by Afghan tradition, culture, history.
Did they ever find a solution that did work?
Well, good question. By the early 1970s, money ran out. Project sort of ended. Then Henry Kissinger, who was then the Secretary of State, visited Kabul, and the Afghan government complained to him that the Americans, after 20-plus years, still haven't fixed this problem. So the job went out to a tiny federal agency that maybe some Iowans have heard of, the U.S. Soil Conservation Service. And they sent over a team of experts who came up with a maddeningly simple solution. Simply get the Afghans to use hand tools to dig little drainage ditches on their farmland. And on the first farms this was implemented on, yields increased by 75% the following year. Problem was by the time this could be implemented across the Helmand River Valley, there was a communist coup in Kabul. Soviet tanks rolled into Afghanistan. And we unfortunately could not sort of implement and deploy this solution in a broad way across the areas in which American engineers had operated. And the lesson of all this, I see this whole effort as sort of a parable of sorts. And it shows that, well, you know, we can finally get the right answer, but sometimes it's simply too late, and that our failure to understand the culture in which we're operating, the traditions, the history, to really listen to what the local people want can bedevil our efforts. Had we in 2009 bothered to really engage with this history, we might have done things differently.
So there was saying someone just tuning into this conversation may have been mistakenly thinking that you were talking about 2009 and the surge. So there are parallels. What are those parallels that you see?
You know, as I was going through and reading this history, it was like if I just changed the dates and the names, I could be reading about today. First off, you had a contractor that was fleecing the Afghans. You know, the idea that contractors were sort of overcharging is not just a phenomenon from the war in Iraq or more recently in Afghanistan, but this stuff has been happening for decades. You had American engineers, you had American diplomats who thought that if they just talked to English-speaking, suit-wearing Afghans in Kabul, in the capital, they would be able to understand what Afghans really think. Well, as we know, as Iowans would know so well, if you come to the United States as a foreigner and you simply talk to people inside the Beltway in Washington, you're not getting really a real understanding of what people in our country think. Those in the heartland have a very different view of matters than those in the capital. And we deluded ourselves into thinking we knew what the Afghans wanted because we were talking to educated, English-speaking, suit-wearing people in Kabul. We thought that the Afghans would understand modern agricultural techniques. We thought they would want to live in modern post-tribal societies. There were a whole host of assumptions that just did not comport with reality. And in many ways, those same assumptions are the ones we went to Afghanistan with in 2002 after the 9/11 attacks.
Before we talk more about the modern-day involvement in Afghanistan, I want to ask you about what we can see of this very early project from the 1950s and 60s in Afghanistan. You traveled to these areas, and you went through some of these canals. You saw what has become of these neighborhoods, these canals?
I did. American Marines are fighting and unfortunately getting wounded in some of these very same canals as we speak. These canals are still carrying water to farms in southern Afghanistan. Now, unfortunately, many of those farms are not growing wheat and corn and fruits as had been hoped originally, but are growing opium-producing poppies, the sales of which are being used to help fund the Taliban insurgency.
Okay. If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He is a senior correspondent and associate editor of the Washington Post. His latest book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. And from 2009 to 2011, he reported on the war in Afghanistan for the Post. Join our conversation, your view on our involvement today in Afghanistan, your questions. Also, perhaps you have spent time in Afghanistan, one of the troops there who has returned to the United States, returned to Iowa, or we're one of the civilians there. We'd like you to join our conversation this hour. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. As you mentioned, in 2009, 8 years into the war, an additional, 30,000 troops were sent to Afghanistan by President Obama, a counterinsurgency measure which coincided with a surge of also civil servants and aid workers. President Obama ordered the surge of troops and aid to Afghanistan, and you went there to report. Describe first the decision-making that went into that surge.
Well, it was a controversial process. In fact, over the course of the year 2009, the president actually sent in or authorized 50,000 additional troops. There was a 30,000 troop surge that you noted. But prior to that, in the first weeks after taking office, the president signed off on an additional 21,000 troops. President Obama more than doubled our force levels in Afghanistan. Now, some of this goes back to Obama as a candidate. As Iowans will know well, when Obama was campaigning for the presidency, he argued that Afghanistan was the good war in contrast to Iraq, which he saw as the bad war. And he promised to increase resources for the war effort, both military resources and civilian reconstruction resources. So when he came into office, he had already staked out a very clear position on this. But Obama, the candidate, thought that fixing Afghanistan would only require a modest addition of troops and dollars. And when his military commander said no, in fact, it will take an awful lot more than that. It will take us to essentially having to double force levels and even more and keep those troops there for some years on end. And it will, and the reconstruction effort will take billions upon billions of dollars. It led to a sort of sticker shock in the White House and a real series of agonized discussions, debates between senior generals, the Pentagon, top diplomats, and members of the president's national security team in the White House. And there was a pretty stark split between some of the civilian advisors, principally led by Vice President Biden, who thought that sending more troops, surging forces there, was the wrong approach, that it would not really work. It would be too costly, and the chances of success would be very, very slim. Military commanders who felt that sending additional troops was what helped turn around the situation in Iraq believed that a surge could do something similar in Afghanistan. And ultimately, it fell to the president, who I think my reporting shows was pretty skeptical of all this, but found himself in a very difficult political position, and so ultimately decided to give General Stan McChrystal, who was then the top commander in Kabul, much of what he wanted. The general had asked for 40,000 additional troops in the surge. The president gave him 30,000, although put a deadline on when those troops would start coming home. Mm-hmm. And so soon after that surge, I accompanied the first wave of Marines to go into southern Afghanistan and kept going back to try to see what really was happening on the ground as we were sending those additional troops in.
Right. And you detail this in your book, Little America, in different levels, because as we mentioned, there is a surge of, along with the military, civilian servants, aid workers. So let's take us through the different levels, the challenges that were faced, and the problems that were encountered.
Great question. What I found was the surge was bedeviled by key, serious, enormous mistakes made by all of the organs of our government. Take the Pentagon first and foremost. You know, back in 2009 and 10, the real strategic prize for the Taliban was the southern city of Kandahar. It's the country's second largest city, sort of the spiritual capital for the ethnic Pashtun population. The Talibs were fighting to take over that city because if they did, they'd have a springboard to seize much of the rest of the country as they did in the 1990s. Well, you would think then that we would have sent the majority of the first wave of additional forces to the areas in and around Kandahar to protect it. But instead, we sent them off to the deserts of Helmand province, where those engineers were 6 decades ago. But those places were home to fewer than 1% of Afghanistan's population.
So what was the military's thinking in that? Yeah.
Well, tribal rivalries, not in Afghanistan, but in the Pentagon. That first wave of additional forces was comprised of U.S. Marines. And Marines, God love them, wanted to bring in their own helicopters, their own logistics units. And to do so, they essentially demanded their own patch of the sandbox. And so the only place that could be easily carved up and given to them was a place that was far less strategically important than Kandahar. Because if they had gone to Kandahar, they would have had to work far more closely with U.S. and Canadian Army units. But we wound up squandering the power of that Marine brigade by putting them in a far less essential place. And what about the civilians? You know, there was supposed to be, as you said, a surge of civilians, of diplomats and aid workers to accompany these troops to help rebuild or in some cases build for the first time local governments to provide and help the Afghans learn how to provide basic services to its population like education and health care. Well, that wave of civilians wound up arriving very, very late, in some cases more than a year late. And then many of them wound up staying in the relatively comfortable embassy compound in Kabul, as opposed to getting out into the field, living in those dusty forward operating bases with the troops, providing those necessary services down at the local level. And then the question of reconstruction. You know, Afghanistan has great needs. I mean, the rates of infant mortality and illiteracy are just off the charts over there. They need our help. But in 2010, we tried to spend $4 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars on reconstruction in that country in 1 year. That was more than Afghanistan could reasonably absorb. Not surprisingly, it wound up actually exacerbating the very corruption we were trying to address. And so in all these different ways, I found the execution of the surge was hampered by infighting, by bureaucratic incompetence, and it was a real missed opportunity for the United States and for the Afghan people.
So did the surge – what exactly did the surge accomplish up to this point?
Well, so truth be told, the surge has resulted in in changes on the ground. In areas where we sent our troops, security did improve. And that shouldn't be surprising. You know, our military is the greatest in the world. And when they go into an area, they will go and pursue, in many cases, kill the bad guys. They will help protect the good people of a village or a valley or district. And so things did improve in those places. But because of these other problems, we weren't necessarily improving security quickly enough in the most important areas. We weren't able to build the necessary Afghan institutions to take the baton from our forces. And so the big question we face now is we have improved the situation in pockets of southern Afghanistan and even in some parts of the east, and certainly the capital, Kabul, is a world of difference today than it was a few years ago. The question is, will the Afghans be able to sustain those gains, the gains that we Americans have expended real blood and treasure on? The lives of many Americans have been lost in the service of these security improvements. Will the Afghan army and police force be competent enough to take charge of those areas? Will the Afghan government provide the necessary basic services to win over the population so they don't turn back to supporting the Taliban insurgency? And that's a big open question. And I think it's a big question because other elements of the strategy just were not properly thought through and were not properly executed.
We have just a couple minutes before we have to take a break, but you also recently wrote about how senior Taliban commanders have now shifted toward a new battlefield strategy now that the U.S. and NATO forces have evicted insurgents from a broad part of southern Afghanistan. Quickly tell us, what is that new strategy and how are U.S. forces reacting?
Well, a key part of that strategy is to try to break the efforts by the United States to train and mentor the Afghan security force. And a big part of that effort right now involves Americans working side by side with Afghans to help them. Well, through the infiltration of the Afghan security forces and through these what's called green-on-blue attacks, where American forces are targeted oftentimes by Taliban infiltrators wearing Afghan army uniforms, it's led to a growing distance between U.S. and Afghan forces as American commanders take steps to try to protect U.S. troops there, which is a responsible and reasonable thing to do. But as we pull back and try to safeguard our forces, it means that it's much more difficult to actually provide the necessary training to give the Afghans their own self-sufficiency.
I wonder, with your intimate knowledge of what has happened in the last few years in Afghanistan, and then also you are part of the media, of the Washington Post, but also there are many other media entities. Does what is happening or has been happening in Afghanistan generally match what you see in the mainstream media, or is there a mismatch? And if so, how?
Well, first and foremost, the media isn't really covering the Afghan war all that much. I mean, how many nightly newscasts have segments about the war? How many newspaper front pages have articles about it? You know, we have 68,000 men and women in uniform there, thousands more civilians. You know, neither political candidate talks much about this war. Regardless of where you are on this, whether you think the war is a good thing or a bad thing, whether you think our troops should stay through the promised transition in 2014 or they should all come home tomorrow, we Americans deserve political leaders who will talk about this. And the news media has a job in this too. And I think because of budget cuts, because of other distractions, because Afghanistan is a hard place to get to and dangerous to cover, a lot of news organizations have chosen not to give it a lot of attention.
Please.
And there's another reason. This war has now been going on for 12 years. It's the longest war in our history. And unfortunately, people are tired.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We'll be back with Rajiv Chandrasekaran of The Washington Post. Your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Talking about Afghanistan, he will be speaking tomorrow in Des Moines before the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. Back with more. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and our guest this hour is Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He's a senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post. His new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, it's a book that details the difficulties that followed President Obama's troop surge in Afghanistan. And Mr. Chandrasekharan will be speaking tomorrow to the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. He joins us today, this afternoon, from The Washington Post in our nation's capital. When we left off before the break, we were talking a little bit about how Afghanistan has been talked about, actually ignored in this most recent campaign. What, though, I wonder, have you observed about how each of the candidates, Governor Romney and President Obama, have treated Afghanistan when questioned about it or on the stump?
Well, when they address it, which isn't all that often, it's usually pretty brief, and they seek to turn to other subjects. The president's principal message on Afghanistan is that the situation has improved, the surge sort of worked, and he is on a path to get most of our troops out by 2014. Talking about how he ended the war in Iraq and is moving to end the war in Afghanistan as well. Governor Romney's principal critique of the president's strategy on Afghanistan focuses on Obama's decision to impose a deadline on the surge, saying that that tied the hands of commanders and that he would listen to his commanders on the ground, which incidentally is what Obama says he is doing, in terms of how to draw down forces between now and 2014, a date, the end of 2014, I should note, is when the United States and its NATO allies have agreed with the Afghans to end the international conventional combat mission there. Past 2014, the U.S. and some of our allies may well still keep some forces in Afghanistan to conduct counterterrorism missions and security force training, but the conventional mission will end. But Romney's criticism of Obama is one that he has to tread carefully on because he recognizes that recent polling has shown that even a narrow majority of Republicans no longer believe the war is worth fighting. So by arguing that Obama should have done more, it potentially alienates some Republicans. So he's been trying to calibrate it very carefully by trying to criticize the president, but not going so far as to alienate his base.
A presidential debate scheduled for October 22nd will focus on foreign policy, the debate between President Obama and Governor Romney. I wonder if you had some questions you think each of them should answer about the next 4 years and U.S. involvement in Afghanistan.
Well, I'd like to ask Obama whether he really believed the surge would work and whether he was sort of pushed into it reluctantly. And Governor Romney has said that he doesn't support the idea of trying to come up with a peace deal with the Taliban. Now, does he then think that we can simply kill every last single Talib in that country? How would he propose ending that war? And what level of troops would each man want to keep in Afghanistan in 2015 and beyond?
Is there any evidence that the point that Governor Romney makes about setting a timeline, a deadline, cedes some advantage there that hamstrings the commanders? Is that a valid point?
Well, I think it less hamstrings the commanders than it might provide some resilience to the Taliban, giving them hope that if they just sort of keep their heads down and keep fighting for a couple more years, they'll be at a point at which there are far fewer foreign troops and they can essentially have a much clearer path to trying to topple the Afghan government and its security forces. And I think in a bigger way, it also acted as a disincentive to try to get the Talibs to the negotiating table with the Afghan government and the United States, because they again saw that perhaps the international mission would be drawing down pretty quickly. But at the same time, with this war going on as long as it has, there's very little appetite among the American people to keep on keeping on at current levels. This war, all told, may well cost us $500 billion when all is done. That's an awful lot of money, particularly for a nation in the throes of economic crisis.
Join our conversation with Rajiv Chandrasekaran, senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post, author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, and you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to Afton. Michael is with us from Afton. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Go ahead, please. You're on the air. Welcome.
I was in I first went to Pakistan in 2005, and then I went to Afghanistan in late 5-6.
In what capacity?
As an Army officer.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Pakistan, it was the humanitarian relief effort for the earthquake in 2005. And once that was finished, my unit moved over to Afghanistan in Kandahar. And I got really friendly with the Pakistani people, because I was a kind of a contracting officer, helped close down the effort there too. So I discovered that the people there are just like normal people here. I mean, they worship a little different, and they want basically the same things as the Americans, to be left alone. In Afghanistan, I only got to meet the ANA, the Afghan National Army guys, but the ones that could speak English basically exhibited the same wishes and thoughts as the Pakistani people that I'd met. They just kind of wanted us to go home and leave them alone.
Michael, thank you for your service. Did your involvement change your views on our involvement, U.S. involvement in Afghanistan in this war that's been going on now for 12 years? Did that evolve?
It didn't. It evolved to a more adamant, I don't know. I just think we need to be. I thought we shouldn't be there to begin with. I mean, obviously the Russians didn't do any good, and historically we haven't, except for the ASCS office or the ASC, the irrigation situation. We haven't been successful, or no government agency has been successful in doing anything with Afghanistan. So I say we offer them help, but as far as combat operations, we need to pull our troops out of there today.
Michael, thank you for that view from Afton, 1-866-780-9100. And I wonder, do you hear, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, the political rhetoric, not just perhaps from the presidential candidates, but from all spheres during this political season? Do you hear any politicians' words that you feel are way off the mark when it comes to the situation in Afghanistan that doesn't square with reality that you reported on?
Well, yes, and you hear them from both sides of the political spectrum. You hear on the right, for instance, guys like Senator Lindsey Graham, who think that, we should throw the 2014 deadline out the window and stay as long as we need to stay. Well, we're there technically as guests of the Afghan government at this point. There's no indication that they would want us to continue on like we are for a unlimited period of time. And so would we just stay in an uninvited capacity? And on the far left, and I should say it's not just those on the far left, but people all over the political spectrum who say, let's just pack up and leave tomorrow. Well, A, there's a physical impossibility to that. We have so many troops and so much equipment there that it would take, months and months to really pull everybody and everything back home. But it poses a very troubling dilemma. Americans are tired of this war. They're tired of what it's costing us in dollars, in lives, in limbs. But if we were to leave en masse tomorrow, even if we could do that, it would probably condemn the Afghans to either another Taliban takeover of the government or more likely a renewed civil war, plunging that country into deeper depths of violence, an already chaotic place even more so. Would we feel that was morally acceptable? I know people are tired of this, but when we went in after the 9/11 attacks, we made an implicit promise to the Afghans that if they stood with us against the Taliban, we'd give them a shot at a better, freer life. And I'm not out here trying to crusade for one policy position or the other, but you know, it will be an issue that Americans will have to wrestle with as we draw down, as things inevitably get a little worse over there. What is our responsibility? What is our level of commitment to that country?
Karen is joining us from Ames. Hi, Karen. What's on your mind?
Well, mindful of Afghanistan's reputation as the destroyer of empires, most recently the Soviet Union, I wonder if the guests can compare the amount of time and hopefully money the Soviets spent in Afghanistan to this $500 billion figure that he has quoted, perhaps in constant dollars or a percentage of GDP that it's taken.
We should probably include the loss of life there, too, as the biggest treasure that we've lost.
A far greater loss of life for the Soviets. And the Soviets didn't spend as much because, in part, they ran their military in a far more bare-bones way. They didn't have the advancements that we have in terms of, you know, intelligence and logistics and some of the quality of life that are afforded to our soldiers, all of which have been great improvements in warfare, but do come at a cost. It's costlier for us to move stuff into Afghanistan. Much of it we have to fly or put on ships, whereas the Soviets could move it by land because they shared a border with Afghanistan back in the 1980s, but in a larger sense, it's interesting to look at the Soviet years as a potential model for both what worked and what didn't. In fact, senior American commanders there, when I asked them recently, you know, to what degree are they looking at other wars as models for the future in Afghanistan, they all pointed to the Soviet years and the Soviet withdrawal and how they could potentially avoid repeating some of the Soviet mistakes. You know, it's worth noting that when the last Soviet tanks left Afghanistan, the communist-backed government in Kabul did not fall overnight. It didn't fall a week or a month later. It fell almost 2 years later, after the Soviet Union collapsed and Moscow was unable to keep bankrolling the puppet government in Kabul. And so that begs the question of whether the ability of a non-Taliban government to survive in Kabul may depend less on the number of boots we have on the ground in 2015 than on the willingness of the U.S. Congress to continue funding the Afghan army and the Afghan government. You know, the estimates are that Afghanistan in 2015 and beyond will need something like $4 billion of U.S. assistance per year. That's more than we currently provide in military and non-military aid to Israel, the current largest recipient of U.S. assistance.
Doesn't seem likely in the current budget climate, does it?
Well, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I mean, it's certainly cheaper than the $100 billion we spent on the war last year. So you could argue, wow, this is a lot less. But yeah, that's an awful lot of money at a time when we're having to cut the budget for a lot of domestic programs. And so it's going to be a very interesting fight shaping up. And this real quickly just gets back to the issue of political engagement. You know, if neither candidate really wants to talk about this war, well, they're going to have a tough time, whoever wins and moves into the White House, when 2015 rolls around and they have to convince the American people and convince Congress that it makes sense to continue spending money in Afghanistan.
Okay. Thank you, Karen and Ames, for that question comparing the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan with the U.S. intervention. Let's have another comparison, if I could, as we conclude this hour. Your earlier book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, is a best-selling account of the troubled American effort to reconstruct Iraq your firsthand view of inside Baghdad's green zone. Now, Iraq is not Afghanistan, but I wonder to what extent you can compare and contrast the surge in Iraq under President Bush and the surge in Afghanistan under President Obama.
Well, you know, the surge in Baghdad was largely focused on trying to separate warring parties in a civil war, trying to keep the Sunnis and Shiites from killing more of each other. And so we could use our troops to essentially act as referees. And we were able to really help bring down the violence. Although, truth be told, the reasons for the diminution in violence in Iraq were far more complex than simply the addition of more forces, though the forces did help. In Afghanistan, it doesn't involve trying to separate warring parties in a civil war, at least not yet. What the surge was trying to do was to provide enough security in ethnic Pashtun communities in the southern and eastern part of the country so that residents would feel comfortable enough casting their lot with President Hamid Karzai's government as opposed to with the insurgency. The problem is that in Afghanistan, the government is so corrupt, so rapacious, you know, it's filled with thugs and corrupt warlords, that the locals often turn to the insurgents to protect them from their government. So we were going in saying to the people of Afghanistan, we're here to help bring your government to you. And many of them recoiled and said, whoa, we may not like the Taliban, but we don't like our government either. We don't want you to bring the government to us. And that's something that we just failed to fully understand. You know, officials in Washington seem to think that everybody wants the government brought to them. And, if we look at our own country, we recognize that in many parts of our country, people want to have a little distance from Washington. Well, the same phenomenon exists in Afghanistan. You got a lot of people out there who don't necessarily want the government in Kabul breathing down their neck.
In 2003 and 2004, you were the Washington Post's bureau chief in Baghdad. We don't hear a lot about Iraq these days, even though there's some U.S. presence there. What is the state of affairs there?
Well, it's far from peaceful. It's still pretty dangerous. There are attacks that happen on a fairly regular basis there. But more significantly, the government that is in Iraq, dominated by Shiite Muslims, is much closer to Iran than the United States. And in fact, the government in Baghdad is allowing the Iranians to use Iraqi airspace to send supplies to Syrian President Bashar Assad's government, which is fighting this very, very bloody war with rebels in that country that are seeking to overthrow the Syrian regime. And of course, it's the rebels that have support from the United States and the Western community. So here we have a supposed U.S. ally, the Iraqi government, that is essentially in league with a government that we consider – two governments we consider to be enemies, the Iranian government and the Assad government in Syria. So we've bequeathed a very complex political situation there and one where despite all of the blood and treasure we have expended in that country, we have very, very little influence today.
Less about 2 minutes left. I wonder, the question has been posed and speculated on, how might the Arab Spring have been different had there been no invasion of Iraq by the United States? Did the war in Iraq hasten or inhibit the Arab Spring?
That's a very good question, and there's really no clear answer to it. You know, those who still are supporters of the Iraq War, some senior officials from the George W. Bush administration, have asserted that it was the Iraq War that helped to lead us to the Arab Spring. But there's relatively little evidence for that on the ground. It seems to be a host of other factors as well. In fact, many Arabs looked to the Iraq model and said, actually, having a foreign power come in and overthrow our government isn't something that we really want. And they looked at the chaos that followed and said, that isn't something we want either. And certainly there was quite a span of years between the start of the Iraq War and the events that started to occur in 2011 across the Arab world. And so I think the connection is pretty tangential. And what we're seeing occurring in the Arab world is far more complex and has to do with a host of factors. You know, the most significant of which is a real sense of anger and revulsion toward these long-serving dictators who have ruled that part of the world, and in some cases ruled that part of the world with American support.
Well, from your perspective, very quickly, you have about 30 seconds left. What are the chief concerns the U.S. should have at this point about the changes in the Arab world?
Well, it's going to be messy and chaotic, and certainly it will lead to new American relationships over there. But I think fundamentally we have to recognize that even if some of these countries want to seek new relations, new types of relationships with the United States and with Israel, that these are populations that we still can work with and we still can engage. And many of them, Libya, Egypt, they want good relationships with the United States. They still have a great respect for the United States, particularly our people, our culture, our technology. And so there is ample room for common ground as we move into the future.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, thank you very much for joining us this hour. It's been a pleasure.
A real pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to my trip to Iowa tomorrow.
Okay. Mr. Chandrasekaran will be speaking tomorrow at the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations, tomorrow, Tuesday. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News, produced by Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.